Missouri Senator Jim Talent joining us right now. And Jim, good morning to you.
Good morning, Mark. You're covering the waterfront this morning.
I am trying to keep it all in perspective for people here. The last thing I mentioned there was the Senate passing all of these judicial appointments for the president. I mean, it's not going to be long before common sense takes over the Ninth Circuit again at this rate.
Yeah, I actually think that there's probably been a disproportionate share of those appointments have been in the Ninth Circuit. I actually checked that out of curiosity about 3 weeks ago, but I can't remember the exact numbers now. But yeah, it's evening out there, and it needed to. There was I remember a clerk telling me one time that on particularly immigration cases coming out of the Ninth Circuit, this was years and years ago, right? He said it's almost a presumption of reversal in the Supreme Court because the Ninth Circuit was going off on so many tangents.
And in this particular case, like I see, and I know I've had Hans von Spakovsky and other legal minds on here who've discussed this, that, you know, whatever the politics these days, if somebody can't beat you in the political arena, they try to go to the courts to do it. The resist movement from California all the way to all the other blue states you can think of challenge everything the Trump administration does in court. They seem to judge shop till they find a judge they know will go ahead and throw an injunction on a change until they can try to get into court and change it. Yesterday, the Supreme Court slapped them down again on this asylum issue. And I think this speaks to the problem in this country. If you can't win in the political arena, you have to you shouldn't be able to do it through the courts.
Right. And it would be good if all of us in our minds separated substantive policy from the process rules. In other words, it's important that the process, vitally important that the process rules be neutral and be seen as neutral by everybody. Okay. Because that's what guarantees the right we all have to participate in the game, if you want to call it that. Right. So, and there's no question that if you look at the body of immigration law, control over that is confided in the Congress and the legislative branch, which has in a number of areas, rightly or wrongly, delegated very broad authority to the executive. And what that means is that if you interpret the law in a faithful way, you're going to find that presidents have a lot of discretion on these immigration issues. And that's traditionally what the Supreme Court's held when cases get up there, because that's what the law is. Now, I'd like to see Congress exercise its authority and actually make more decisions instead of just delegating.
Sure.
But it hasn't. I was always for that. Whenever I was involved in trying to write statutes, I would say to people, you know, these are judgments that we, the legislative body, ought to try to make insofar as we can foresee them. Right. But, until that happens, this is, in most cases, what the law says. And that's true whether you elect a Trump or you elect an Obama or somebody else. So, and I think the Supreme Court's pretty much, you know, held that in these cases.
Well, it's interesting. Yesterday, the Supreme Court issued a ruling lifting the injunction against the new asylum rules. The asylum rules are really modeled after what a lot of courts, at least internationally, and I believe maybe the UN, has suggested that if you're seeking asylum, you should go to the nearest country. That's all that says. In other words, if you're in Guatemala and you're seeking asylum, the first place you're going to encounter is probably Mexico or the first country you come to. It just makes sense. And yet, in the dissent yesterday, Justice Sotomayor dissented strongly because the ban comes at a time when the stakes couldn't be higher. To me, she's making a political point on this case and not looking at the facts of the law.
Oh, I agree. Listen, there's one of the problems with all of this is it is discrediting the idea of refugee status. And, you know, for years and years, there was a basic agreement that if you were a genuine refugee, which means somebody fleeing for their life and limb because of a clear political or religious or racial or something, persecution. I mean, it was put in place because of what happened in World War II, that you could get permanent status in the United States, even if you would not otherwise have been eligible for it under the immigration laws, right?
Right.
Now, subject to some presidential discretion. Well, when you take that category and you turn it, you know, you claim it's still refugee or asylum status, but what you're really turning it into is this enormous loophole, which means that anybody who can get here can stay here. Then what you do is you discredit that whole idea. And refugee status does not mean somebody coming here because they're poor in their home country. So if you really are a refugee, why shouldn't you stop in the first country where you're no longer in peril?
Right. No, it makes sense. I this morning I used the analogy that it would be like needing a police officer down here in the city, but deciding that you're going to drive out to Chesterfield to find one. You're just going to skip the first four jurisdictions you come to because you want to go find a police officer in Chesterfield instead of one in the city. It's almost the same thing.
And the best way to deal with these kinds of cases where there are a lot of refugees, where there's tremendous persecution or genocide or something, is to establish camps and shelters for people close to the location where they're being persecuted. Now, why is that the best thing? Because in the first place, it protects the interests of countries, you know, against having a lot of people coming in who wouldn't be let in through their normal immigration policy, but also it helps those people more. It's much easier to get to a camp in a neighboring country than it is to travel hundreds or thousands of miles across all kinds of obstacles to try and get to the United States or Sweden or wherever you're trying to go, right? And so, I mean, all this, again, if it's just refugee policy, this doesn't make any sense. Right. And that's because that's not what it is, because this is an attempt for people to, in essence, throw open the borders of the United States.
Then AOC would be able to refer to it as a concentration camp. Jim, you're trying to set up concentration camps for asylum seekers.
Well, and to the extent the United States participates in that, and we should, okay, but it's important to make certain that the conditions are good.
Right.
But they're obviously not. I mean, you know, It is the most humane and effective way of actually helping people most of the time.
Yeah, I wanted to get your comments on an interaction that took place yesterday in the House. So there was a committee that held a hearing on immigration. It was basically a dog and pony show. They brought people up to try to prove that there's something wrong with our current immigration policies. In fact, the first bite is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez apologizing to these illegal immigrants that they dragged before Congress for the United States policies. Go to cut four.
I'd like to apologize to you on behalf of the United States of America for the dehumanizing policies that they are pursuing that are frankly targeting you and targeting many people in the United States. And we're fighting for a better country that we can be proud of when it comes to how we treat all people.
Now, she's already proven that she's willing to say and do anything to try to make her point on immigration, but they made the mistake of inviting Tom Homan, the former acting director of ICE. And Debbie Wasserman Schultz addressed him at one point, and her time was running out. So she, instead of asking him a question, she claimed that everything he'd said to the committee was a lie. And then she was out of time, and she wasn't going to give him a chance to respond. And he started talking anyway. Go ahead and play that.
If I can respond to the earlier remark from Washington Schultz, I forgot more about this issue than you ever know. So if you say my testimony is inaccurate, it's wrong. Everything I said here is accurate. Bottom line, if you want to go toe-to-toe, I'm here. I'm here in my own time to speak to the American people about what's false
and
what's
fact. I'm sure happy to go toe-to-toe with you, Mr. Homan.
Well, I'm
happy to
here.
Do that any day.
But you got to let me respond to your question rather than dropping a bomb and running away.
You dropped a bomb and you ran away. I'm sorry, but I would love to see more witnesses come back at him like that.
Did she say he was lying or inaccurate? And it matters. Okay.
And I'd have to. Yeah. I listened to the bite earlier, and his comment was right after that. So we didn't play the first part of it. What she said was, we need to have all of his testimony from today stricken from the record or marked down as. She either called him a liar or called him inaccurate. One of the two.
Okay. Well, this liar is worse.
Worse.
But in either event, this is what I was referring to before, and I don't want to lose half your audience by mentioning the word process again, but this really matters, if and maybe matters more in the long run. So I chaired a committee for 4 years. Okay, so when a witness is if attacked personally, which is what you're doing if you say they lie, or when their credibility is broadly attacked, which is what you're doing if you say everything they say is inaccurate, it is very important for the chairman, notwithstanding the time limits, to say, okay, I'm going to give you, the witness, an opportunity to respond to that, okay? And he should not have to jump in like that and grab it. I don't blame him for doing it. You can't let the members on the dais take advantage of their position in order to discredit people in an unfair fashion. You have to give the witness an opportunity to respond, and you have to do that on a bipartisan basis. I'm actually kind of proud because for 4 years, that's what I did. Now, good. I had a committee that was a pretty bipartisan committee, the Small Business Committee, so it was easier. But I didn't tolerate that from the members. I would just have jumped in and said, I'm going to give the witness an opportunity, a reasonable opportunity to respond to what you had to say. And see, the chairman didn't do that. And you really need to do that. That's how the committee is able to work in a way and be seen as fair, you know, by everybody.
Senator Talent, before we run, I'm sure it does. Before we run out of time here, I want to get your reaction to what happened with John Bolton this week. Play cut 8 for me, please.
And, you know, John wasn't in line with what we were doing. And actually, in some cases, he thought it was too tough what we were doing. Mr. Tough Guy, you know, you have to go into Iraq. Going into Iraq was something that he felt very strongly about. So we're right now in for over $7 trillion into the Middle East. And I don't say it was his decision. You had a president and you had other people also, but he was very out there, I can tell you.
You know, I don't know. I'm a John Bolton fan. I always have been since he was UN ambassador. How do you feel about how this was handled this week?
Well, I don't like these kinds of public debates between the president and his subordinates. Now, that's his style, okay? And after a while, we kind of all get used to it. My major concern here is the level of turbulence in the national security establishment. Now, Trump likes to move people around, and within limits, that's okay. I mean, presidents should have the kind of personnel policies that they're most comfortable with. But we've been moving through too many national security advisors. I think a big part of the problem is they took so long to replace Mattis, and this has created a sense of too much turbulence and transitioning within the national security establishment. Look, on some of these issues, from what I can tell from the outside, I think Trump was where Trump and Bolton disagreed. Evidently, I think Trump was right, like on the Iran strike. But no, it's certainly not my style to do this. It's the president's, you know, he's the one with the name on the door. He holds the bag for the results. So he is entitled to the people that he wants.
Yeah. I think that's what the Secretary of State pointed out in his news conference the other day. In fact, that, you know, it's his staff. He gets to have who he wants
right.
around
and
him.
Where the results are good, he gets the credit. Where they're not, it's his name that's on the door. That's what it goes with. The underlying issue here is that Trump, like Obama before him, and this is ironic because the two of them are very similar in their impulses towards the Middle East. They don't like being involved in the Middle East. And they keep pushing their people to find ways to get out. But the fact of the matter is that we have very substantial security interests there. So we can't just completely extricate ourselves.
It's a great point. Jim, right. I'm out of time. Thank you so much.